Mystic Fire, video and audio, proudly presents Terence McKenna. History ends in green. This is tape 4 of a 6-cassette series.
Reincarnation.
Well, we talked a little bit this morning about the relationship of these ideas to death, and how shamans claim that they're seeing into a world of souls. I don't know. I find it... The thing which really got me is the presence of these English-speaking entities in the trance. I mean, that I did not expect. From Jung and from Freud, you expect residual memories, but not these entities, these beings. And then the question is, where are they? Who are they? Well, a conservative, the possibilities are fairly limited. They are either dead people, because they are clearly more like people than like animals. They, after all, speak and communicate and have intentionality in a purely intellectual realm. So that means they're like people, but they're not like anybody you've ever seen. So are they dead people? That's one possibility. Or are they extraterrestrials? Well, that's another possibility, but the problem is we've never seen an extraterrestrial. We've got dead people all over the place. We know that there are dead people, but we don't know if anything survives bodily death. Well, then the other source is, are they from the future? Are they future people? We see people now, so we can extrapolate there must be people in the future. They might be different from us. Perhaps they could come back. So those are the fairly uncomfortable and limited choices. They're either an advanced state of humanity, they're the souls of the dead, or they're some kind of extraterrestrial dwellers in a parallel continuum. Well, now, you're supposed to generate hypotheses conservatively. That means that the dead lead by a mile. Just by logical deduction. So the strangest hypothesis turns out to be the most likely, that these are the souls of the dead, and it's possible that reincarnation is something where at a certain point in historical time we find out about it. We learn literally the secrets of death. And this would be big news. It would be quite a surprise in the forward thrust of scientific rationalism if what it was going to lead to was opening a communication line to the ancestors.
Right. I just wanted to add here about the Peyote Church, because it seems to really fit. And I had questions about initiation, because I think that's really missing in a lot of this mess of material. I just wanted to share one vision I had in peyote during a ceremony, and that was there was a feeling inside my body that something was going up and down my spine, something was moving around. And when I closed my eyes, there was a bird flying inside my body. And as I got deeper into it, it was a flock, and then there was a lake, and then there was forests, and then I started crying because it was just very pristine and beautiful. And it got wider and wider in there, and other species that are now extinct started appearing and saying, "Don't worry, we've all gone inside." Which was like a trap, really too much for me to take, because it was really a sense of what these Indian people have been teaching me in the past 10 years, is that the ancestors do exist. Death is simply, you know, taking off masks, and that they do come and teach, and that they do live inside, and that there is and has been and always will be a way of communicating to the past, our past, since we have time in this linear way. To ask for information on that. And I'm real interested in just, again, asking about initiation, in the sense that I feel that a lot of the things that's missing here is the context of the circle of people who are committed to ceremony, which is historically and otherwise, really the setting that gives us the return to that state you were talking about earlier, which was, you know, that group consensus sense of support and love and sharing the clan, the tribe, and everything. Do you see, for instance, use of psychedelics moving in a ceremonial or ritual fashion in a way of creating new ways of coming together as people to heal that circle, that shield?
Well, where it's most enduring, I think this is how it ends up being done. People do the work on their own, but then they tend to form into circles. This is how I think the serious psychedelic voyaging gets done, because the circle gives people permission and courage. If we had an unbroken cultural tradition, we would be initiated by master shamans. As it is, we've had to sort of reinvent the whole of the world's oldest religion. And we haven't done that bad a job. I mean, we shouldn't feel that we have to fault ourselves. The anthropological literature of the world is vast. And if you spend time with it, you will know more about these things on a certain level than most people in a traditional culture. It was very interesting being in the Amazon. You would go with the people and they would show you their plants, and it might come up that you would say, did you know that the Conibo, who live 50 miles away from you, also use this plant, and they call it X? And they would just be astonished, say, how do you know this? Well, you couldn't explain that you had read it in a Harvard Museum botanical leaflet. But that was how you knew it. You knew it because you'd done your homework. So what they had was tremendous vertical initiation into one culture. But what you can bring to this that is very useful and respected is a tremendous general knowledge about this. Say, well, did you know that in Africa people use the same plant and they do it like this? Or did you know that in Indonesia similar practices are going on? And so we've reconstructed a shamanism. But from then spending time with ayahuasqueros in the Amazon and other kinds of shamans in other places, I really see that it wasn't as formal as we thought. There are rituals and songs and techniques, but the spirit of shamanism is open-minded and open-ended. And these people are really doing this out of curiosity to find out the mythological structures created by any kind of shamanic system are largely for the consumption of the client, not the shaman. The shaman knows that this is all provisional. And what we found with the shamans in the Amazon was great curiosity, great willingness to try out novel concepts, to integrate weird ideas into their own cosmology, electromagnetism, viruses, computers. They loved all these things because they saw them as metaphors that they could integrate into their visions. The flying saucer is a metaphor like this, very strong in the ayahuasca mythology. Liz, did you want to say something?
Eric, you said earlier today or yesterday, sometimes, you guess what happens when we write things down, the domain in which we operate lies within our minds. And I'd like to know how that, I'm always confused about real and not real. All these realities you've been describing with little L's, et cetera, is that within your mind? And is the English, because that's the language you're most familiar with?
Well, I think what I meant when I said the domains in which we operate are all within our minds is that inside culture, it's all whatever we say it is. In other words, other than that it's day and night, nature doesn't say much to us. We pursue our activities all inside a construct of culture that comes out of language. So that's what I meant when I said that it's all within the domain of our minds. I mean, it's all within the human world and potentially affected by the human mind. The problem of real and unreal, which is supposed to be a naive problem, is one I have too. I think that the real world is so strange that it's just almost too freakish to suppose. You know, I quote all the time J.B.S. Haldane, who said the world is not only stranger than we suppose, it's stranger than we can suppose. This is a tremendous liberation once you grab onto it. It's really true. I mean, how many of you know that? That it's really true that the world at any moment could come completely and utterly apart. And have you seen that happen? You know, that's really what I'm concerned to communicate, is the provisional nature of reality. It does have a certain momentum, and thank God for it, because, you know, who could stand it if it were always coming unglued? But on the other hand, you know, if you're an edge runner, if you keep poking, there are these things you can do, and then it just springs to pieces. And I don't say it's all lies. It doesn't seem to operate in the domain of truth and lies. It's just that this is all just such a limited slice to what's possible. That was very liberating for me to find out. I remember the first time I smoked DMT, and when I came down, they practically had to hog-tie me. And all I could say was, I can't believe it. I cannot believe it. And I couldn't. I still can't. I mean, the whole impetus for my career is to convince myself that somebody else has seen the same thing and that they can't believe it either. Because, you know, it's so weird that it always floats to the top. It always calms down and turns back into this. You know, rooms full of people sitting, listening. But beneath that is just this really unspeakably bizarre thing. Not as we're told it should be. Not, in fact, as we're told it isn't. The one thing they tell you it isn't, it is. It is. It is made of magic. Anything can happen. I mean, these, to have elves by the thousands pouring into your apartment, how can a rational, what is a person to do with that? You know, because it's that what happens is that in a single moment, in the privacy of your own reality, it's revealed to you that all of history is a mistake, a delusion, a horrible misunderstanding, but you're given no evidence. Only the conviction that this is so. And then you're set down among your fellows, and they don't know what you're talking about, can't understand why you've become so agitated and addled. And I think this is what we all as psychedelic people live with. And we suspect each other. We can't be sure that anybody has ever really seen the true naked heart of the stone but ourselves. And so then it's this tremendous catalyst to language, to try and build metaphors, to try and get the nod of recognition so that we are satisfied.
It's not really stranger than the real world, you say?
It is the real world.
I mean, in the so-called real world. I mean, that's...
Well, it's more brightly colored. It's moving faster. Why is it so brightly colored? Why is it moving faster? I mean, what I've noticed in my DMT experiences, and when I realized this, it was with a certain amount of horror, was you break into this space. It's dome-like, it's warm, it's diffusely lit. There are all these self-transforming machine elves and their toys, which also are singing and condensing and making objects and so forth and so on. The whole thing is like triggers just wonder, cascades of wonder. But then I realized after seeing this several times and trying to pay attention and hold my mind steady that this is someone's idea of a reassuring environment for human beings. It is, in fact, literally a playpen of some sort. Well, that means that I'm not seeing who's ever on the other side. I am emerging into an artificial construct of some sort, entirely their creation. Well, then it just begins to lift this veil, and there's this howling begins, and you just begin to fall forward into it, and you realize, you know, it is the Sephiroth and the Shekinah. It is the howling between the worlds, but it is approached through an infinite number of veils that reassure, coddle, control, confine. But you can move toward it as fast as you dare. But it is entirely transforming and entirely real. It was a great realization for me to understand that there was no limit to how far you could go. That we all make a certain choice. Once you discover psychedelics, always before that, spiritual progress is, you know, grunt work. Suddenly, you're standing on ice cubes in terms of spiritual progress and how you make it. How do you control it? And the answer is most people go a certain distance and then give up, get off, stand there and talk about it. But there's nothing holding any of us back from becoming unrecognizable, not only to our friends and loved ones, but to ourselves. You know, the stories told of the Taoist guy up on Cold Mountain, and he's been up there 25 years, and occasionally people see him, and yes, he's still alive. Well, any one of us could become that person, could march off into a dimension of magical narcissism so alien to the concerns of other people that we would have to go and live up on the crags and in the mist and eat bird nests or whatever they do up there, you know. Well, so then that puts a whole different light on the spiritual quest, because it means that we're holding it back rather than lashing it forward to ever greater exertion. And I think that's the proper attitude, because the depth of spirit is infinite, and in its benevolence toward suffering humanity it has made itself available in infinite amounts. So then it's for us to somehow come to terms with this. It's like having a living religion. It is having a living religion, because it's having an infinite source of gnosis, of understanding, available. Somebody, yes.
Wilbur has recently written about meditation as a preview to death. He says that it conditions you to enter the bardo, so you won't shy away from the idea and go into it fully. Do you see any role of meditation as a preparation for psychedelics, or would you just talk about meditation and your opinion on it in general?
Well, it teaches you to sit still, which is a precondition for psychedelics. I mean, you know, keeping still is one of the hexagrams of the I Ching. People often ask the question you asked, or in slightly different forms. They say, well, isn't there another way to get there? Is it so narrow? Is it so specific to these plants? And, you know, the truth is, I don't know. I'm not an expert. All I know is based on my experience. In my experience, these things can only be approached, and who would want to approach them any other way? I mean, we don't want this to become so generalized that by closing your eyes and ripping off a few Om Tat Sats, you fall into the kind of states I'm talking about. I mean, that would be extremely unwelcome and nearly pathological. I don't understand this problem with how you achieve it. To my mind, obviously you can't do it by yourself. Obviously you can't do it on the Natch because it's a meeting with another entity. There has to be an other, and it has to be objectified, even if it's as a plant or a mushroom. So basically how I read these meditation texts is they teach you about psychological phenomena. They teach you what you may see when you close your eyes and sit for days and watch. The thing about meditation in my own experience is that it's just tremendously boring. However, everything you're doing will be very useful to you when you take a psychedelic. Then it works. Then there is this flow of imagery. I am maybe a very lumpen person, but that's all right because a lot of us are lumpen, and I wish to speak for that slice. There may be supreme aesthetes balanced on such razor's edge of metabolic peculiarity that at every moment they are at one with the mystery. But that butters no bread for the rest of us, you know. We're trying to create a kind of democratic consensus here about this stuff. And it seems to me the plants were put there for this purpose, and they achieve it so easily. I mean, I've practiced yoga at times in the past and had some amount of success with triggering exotic states. Difficult and time-consuming. And then they always told you that wasn't what it was about anyway, and you were becoming distracted by phenomena. Well, why bridle then at just chowing down on 5 grams of mushrooms with the knowledge that, you know, you'll be fine in 12 hours? So it's really a matter of using the tools. There are all kinds of altered states, weird states, states of sexual abstinence and states of various kinds of agitation and this and that. But what I'm interested in is just this very specific set of phenomena, and I don't really make any claim for it to say, you know, this is the spiritual path. I don't say that. What I say is this is the most interesting thing around. But it's very specific. For instance, I don't like drugs which mess with your mind in the sense of that distort your value assessing ability. The drug which comes to mind is ketamine. Ketamine is an extremely powerful synthetic drug that creates an experience which, if you haven't had ketamine, you don't know what this experience is. It's that specific to it. But, hell, the house could burn down around you and it would arrive as an unconfirmable rumor on the dark side of your metaphysical imagination with this stuff. I mean, you would never lift a hair, it would never enter your mind that there was a problem. Datura is like this too. Datura severely distorts reality. The day I knew that my experiments with Datura had come to an end was one day in Nepal. I was talking to a friend of mine in the market about his Datura experiments and how much he'd been taking recently. And in the course of the conversation, it came out that he thought we were in his apartment. And I looked at this person, that there had been severe degradation of core information processing, and that, you know, we had to get back on the wagon or we weren't going to get out of there. Let me describe for a moment the state of mind on DMT is, if you keep your, there is a tendency to give way to absolute astonishment. But if you can hold that back and pay very close attention to what's going on, you will discover that it didn't do anything to you. That here you are and suddenly in the midst of a raging universe of hallucination, and you are you, and you are who you were before. And it has not in any way inflated, repressed, suppressed, distorted, or skewed anything. You're just saying, aha. Wow, I'm really smashed. The input is reaching overload, but there must be this core observer who's never overwhelmed. And this persists with most of the tryptamines. Now, sometimes it is overwhelmed, but when it's overwhelmed, it's the last thing to be overwhelmed and the first thing to pop back into existence at the end of the period of overwhelmment. So sometimes on ayahuasca, you just lose it for a period of time, 20 minutes or something. But then you reconstruct and you're there like a little cork popping up to the top of the ocean. Say, oh, here I am. It's me again. So this is very important to be able to observe. With DMT, the reason it's so fascinating is because the input, the content, seems to be almost entirely confined to the visual cortex. It's something that you look at, and it comes toward you, and it relates to you. There is a weird distortion of body image, but it's small potatoes compared to most of what's going on. And you can I-thou relationship. So, my tastes may be narrower than some people. Some people just like to get, you know, fucked up. And they go one way and then another and a few reds and a shot of this and a hit of that. And, yeah.
No, there's really nothing to be frightened about with the elves. I mean, it sounds like they could be demons if they want to be.
They could be. They're demonic. They've never done anything bad to me. It's that their humor. It's like being trapped in a Bugs Bunny cartoon. I mean, we all know how funny a Bugs Bunny cartoon is, but have you noticed that the humor is all based on explosions, falling anvils, and agony? And so imagine if you were actually in a Bugs Bunny cartoon. You know, I mean, it's a parody of that situation. I don't know. The vibe of these creatures is very strange. They're knowledge holders. Like, I've often thought that what they were was meme traders, because they had the same feeling that I associated with the Indian hashish traders. They're meme traders. They are, when they spread out all this stuff in front of you and are saying, look at this, these marvelous jeweled objects, these are things they're selling. They want to trade. They're asking, what have you got? You know, what can you show us? Your Rolex, your fountain pen, your political beliefs, your sexual orientation. You know, what do you want to trade? And so they're sort of like cosmic pack rats. You know, pack rats will take something, but they always leave something. Have you ever dealt with pack rats? Oh, pack rats are fascinating because they, if one finds you, it will leave an object in trade for whatever it takes. And the trick is so you give it a paper clip, it gives you a fountain pen. And there are stories in the gold country of Colorado and California of people having relationships with pack rats where they were trading its thumbtacks and it was bringing them gold nuggets until, you know, they had enough gold nuggets that they could leave off trading with varmints and get a life.
From your experience of other cultures that use psychedelics and have used them, do they always make people kinder and gentler?
Do psychedelics always make people kinder and gentler? Do they make us kinder and gentler? Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, as I get older, I ask it slightly differently of myself. I ask the question, you know, if this stuff is so great, you know, what is so great about us that we're any different from anybody else? Or are we just like holy rollers and Taoists and Hasidic Jews and everybody else who thinks they've found the final answer? What is so great about it? The answer to your question is, I don't think so. I think of the Yanomami culture, certainly from the exterior, this looks like a fairly brutal culture. The men, it's the only culture where DMT is a regularly abused drug, and the men blasted up each other's nostrils with these hollow tubes. And then the name of the game is two guys square off, and you plant your feet flat on the ground, and the guy who goes first hits the other guy as hard as he can with the flat of his palm in the chest. And the game is to knock the person over. So you absorb this blow, and then it's your turn, and you get up and you do it. And these two guys, total saliva to the four winds, will stand and do this till somebody is knocked off their pins. Well, so then you ask them, what's going on here? You know, is this like the Super Bowl? Is this fun for you guys? And they explain that they have demons that live in their chest, and they collect these demons on their psychedelic trips, and the more demons you have, the harder it is to knock you over. So they're doing this thing. But they're also lacerating each other with clubs and this sort of thing. I think that it's fouled up. I have the faith that if you have psychedelic religious ritual in combination with group sex in a small tribal group whose economy is based on nomadic pastoralism, that then it will be very, very hard for these people to maintain a neurotic lifestyle. But that if you interfere with any of this, then you'll get anxiety. And so you have psychedelic cultures, but the Yanomamo, this is a culture of male dominance and sexual anxiety and, you know, a lot of tweaked stuff. But I think that the main thing is to be that the cultural group must take the psychedelic frequently enough that the ego does not form, and that the specific manifestation of ego that you want to watch out for is concern for male paternity. That once it's gone that far, it's lost, and then because then there's male-male rivalry for women and territory. Yeah.
I'd like to go back to the Irish elves for a second. My wife came across an article. She's Irish, and came across an article last year, drawing between lighthouses and possibility of seasonal ceremonial use of shrooms. And we sent you that article.
I remember that article.
I was wondering if you followed that up, and in light of your having written the introduction to the
Celtic faith in, or the fairy faith in Celtic countries. Well, it would be very interesting to prove psilocybin use in ancient Ireland. That people who have been to places like Ionia and like that say they're just overrun with mushrooms. And yet it's not explicit in any Celtic source. There's a lot of psilocybin in Europe. I mean, I was surprised. I thought that it occurred rarely, and so you could make the argument that it was possibly there. But last year when I did a speaking tour of Germany, and we were from Hamburg clear down to Munich and into Switzerland, everywhere there were mushrooms. And we would talk like we're talking here and then have lunch recess, and people would come back 2 hours later with small grocery bags full of these things. Well, I don't understand the peculiar... there must be something we don't quite grok about why the mushroom image is taboo. Maybe because it looks like a penis, but that doesn't really sound right to me. But why is it so rarely portrayed in all these areas where it must have been used? For instance, in the northwest coast of Oregon and Washington, there are something like 22 indigenous species of psilocybe. No anthropological record of mushroom use by the Northwest Coast Indians, who were clearly paying attention. I mean, when you look at their carving and painting, they were paying attention. Where is the record of the mushroom use? in ancient Ireland, this, and throughout the Celtic area into Germany and Bohemia, no visible use of in the old Europe that Mariangan Buddhist talks about. Again, a prohibition of the image. So this is puzzling, not easy to understand. I would like to believe that in Africa, 15,000 years ago, the primary religion of humanity was goddess-worshipping pastoralism based on sacramental use of mushrooms. But again, the physical evidence is just a few petroglyphs, drawings on stone, and it isn't a strongly proven case, so it's not well understood. It's hard to believe that the Irish weren't mixed up in this somehow. I mean, it seems so basic to the Irish soul. Yeah.
How many grams of mushrooms do you recommend taking?
5 dried grams. And you should weigh it. You should invest in a little scale and weigh it, because people eyeball it and they inevitably choose much less than is the correct amount. And if you're taking fresh mushrooms, you should take like 60 grams, you know, because it dries down by a factor of more than 9 to 1.
You're into cubensis?
Cubensis. We're always talking about Staphylococcus cubensis because that's the one people cultivate. Some of the wild ones are stronger, can be taken in smaller amounts. But I think it's good to take Staphylococcus cubensis because then you know what you're getting, because it's, you know, some of these small psilocybes look physically very much like Gallerina species that have irreversible liver destructive toxins in them. So if you eat a Gallerina, you'll have a very bad experience, or maybe a very good experience, but none of us will ever know.
Speaking of mushrooms, how about the Amanita muscaria? I've heard both pros and cons on that.
Well, this is a very controversial mushroom that is wide. You all know this mushroom, the red one with the white dots on top of it, the toadstool of European mythology. It's used in Siberia and places like that as an intoxicant, and Gordon Wasson thought that it was the basis of soma, but it now looks like it probably isn't the basis of soma, and that it's very variable, seasonally variable, geographically variable, genetically variable. So you never know what you're going to get. It's very hard to obtain a reliable, desirable intoxication from that mushroom. It's another one of these. There are a lot of these things that are sickening and distorting, and that after you've gone through a night with them, you feel reborn because you're so damn glad you lived through it. But they're not really psychedelic, you know. Any other
question? I said something before about this idea about the dead ancestors.
Oh, yeah, what about?
I saw an ad recently in some New Age magazine that stated just because they're dead doesn't mean they're smart. An IQ test that you can give.
An IQ test to your ancestors?
Well,
that's great. We've needed that for a long time. Just the simple test for grammatical correctness would eliminate.
The other thing I was going to say was that I had some experience with ketamine, and I did not find it at all distorted my central observer self, the way you talked about Datura. And I think at the height of a DMT trip, you wouldn't be able to do much with a fire in the house either. I mean, when you take a psychedelic that powerful, ketamine or DMT, you make sure you put yourself in a situation where you don't have to worry about physical surroundings.
True.
Whatsoever, so.
But the thing that I noticed about ketamine is the first thing that happens is you stop worrying. The very first thing. Before there's any manifestation of any symptom whatsoever, you kind of, oh, what the hell? And that's the beginning, but it's all that you're not paying attention like you should. Well, I think it also depends on the dose. How much did you do?
50 milligrams to 100 milligrams.
Yeah, well, see, I didn't do it that many times, and each time I did it quite a bit. And it was reality obliterating for sure. I've noticed that people who get into ketamine tend to dose downward rather than upward, tend to settle in somewhere around 50. And this is probably, I shouldn't even be speaking about it because I don't know what 50 is like. I know what 150 is like. With the DMT, the main thing is, at first you think, my God, how could anyone ever retain or remember any of this? But it's really that you have to learn to control your own astonishment. That it's like having a heart attack of wonder. And after you've had the experience three or four times, you just learn to be cool. You say, you know, I'm not going to give way to a bunch of exclamations about how amazing this is. And they tell you to do that. They say, don't start raving about how amazing it is. Pay attention to what we're doing. We know that you're blown out. We know that you're amazed. Yes, yes. Now, pay attention to this. And then they try to convey this linguistic thing, this visible language. And I don't understand, you know, what this is all about. Has this always been what they've tried to convey? Is the message always the same? Is there a new urgency about visible language? Or is it, you know, how much of the message is already present in me? Is it a message tailored for me? Like this question of whether or not these things are... Then you get into questions like, what ancestors are they? Like, I do not feel when I break into the DMT space that this is my dead mother or my grandparents. I feel that it's more, that it's just sort of local spirits.
Grandma, you became a self-transforming machine.
Yes, who would have thought? A little white-haired old lady. And then sometimes I think that the reason it's so hair-raising is because the chief soul in this weird place is actually your soul. And that the hair-raising aspect is, it's not just any dead person or a dead relative.